Okay, I know a lot of you, if not most of you, but for those of you who don't, I'm Father Charles Erlinson. I am the assistant rector at Good Shepherd, Reformed Episcopal Church over long way from Tyler, Texas. I am I teach at the school there. I work part-time at the Prayer Book Society, and I wanted to mention something about that. First, the project that I'm working on, which is half of my work now, actually, is called the Common Prayer Catechesis Project. And what the Prayer Book Society has done is they've begun to write a six-year adult Sunday school curriculum. The first 2 years are based on the traditional catechism. It's something that there's been a crying need for actually decades. The last time people really took seriously the traditional catechism as a teaching tool and actually published resources to help do that was probably back about the 1920s, like almost a century ago. So what I'm writing is a two-year adult curriculum based on the four pillars of the catechism, and that's part of a larger six-year adult curriculum project. I've got a lot of these brochures if you're interested, so please take a look at that. That's something that hopefully the first year of curriculum will be published later this year in the fall. Secondly, as a lot of you know, I write a daily Bible devotional commentary called Give Us This Day Devotional, which you can find online at giveusthisdaydevotional.com. I also have a couple of books that are for sale at Father Sparks' table for the Anglican Bible and Book Society, if you are interested in those. And for those who are latecomers, including my daughter, there's an occupational hazard. Here you go, Joe. You pass those down. Here's the handout. What I titled my talk, and it's more like any good research project, you start out here and it always ends up there. I started out with my PhD studying the poetry of John Keble and wrote enough material for three books, none of which made it into my final PhD thesis. So this is sort of like that, but not as bad. The title that I gave Father Casey months ago was The Inkling of Joy, Male Friendship and Shared Desires. And that was the seed of what I wanted to do, is looking at the inklings not in terms of the literature, but in terms of something deeper and more fundamental, which is the friendships between the inklings that helped to facilitate and produce this literature. And I want to particularly focus on the character of male friendship. It turns out that I'm not talking as much about that, but about friendship more generally speaking. So maybe I shouldn't hang, I don't need to hang the sign outside that this says no girls allowed, with the, you know, spelled with a U. But a lot of the focus will still be on male friendship. Maybe to set the mood, I should have provided enough scotch and tobacco for everybody, but I know some of you are under 21, so I decided against that. You're going to hear a lot of workshops on the inklings, and especially, I think, on their literature, aspects of the literature. But again, I want to focus on friendships because it's something that is universally important. And once I locked onto that theme, it's like any good major generative topic, you see it everywhere. And it's like everything now seems to be about friendships, which isn't so surprising, as we'll see. I want to convey to us a vision of Christian friendship in a world that is particularly lonely. Oftentimes, hell is imagined to be a place that is specifically lonely. It's a world without God. And what we've done in the postmodern world is we've created a world where we don't have community anymore, because we've really bought into the myth of the individual, the autonomous individual, which has been a disaster. I want to especially leave you with a vision for the power of friendships, and in particular, that of male friendship, because we're going to see that that's something that is really something of a lost art in our culture at this time, in particular. I want to begin by looking at Lewis's definition of friendship. And like with a lot of things, including the word joy, Lewis's definitions are a little bit idiosyncratic. That is, they're not exactly what you might expect. They're not exactly strictly taken from the Bible. He writes a lot about it. Back in 1940, in The Problem of Pain, he wrote this. He said, and you've got part of this quote in your handout, "Are not all lifelong friendships born at the moment when at last you meet another human being who has some inkling," there's that word, "but faint and uncertain even in the best, of that something which you were born desiring, and which beneath the flux of other desires and in all the momentary silences between the louder passions night and day, year by year, from childhood to old age, you were looking for, watching for, listening for. You have never had it. All the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been but hints of it, tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But if it should really become manifest, if there ever came an echo that did not die away, but swelled into the sound itself, you would know it. Beyond all possibility of doubt, you would say, here at last is the thing I was made for. And the kinds of friendships that Lewis developed, that's what he felt was the beginning of those friendships, was seeing somebody who had that same sense, that same hint, if you will, of God and heaven,
or what Wordsworth would have said,
intimations of immortality, that hint that there's something greater, that you have something in common that you have with somebody who sees that same thing, even for a moment. And there's that joy that's therefore shared in this friendship. Joy, therefore, is kind of a partaking of that for which you were born. Now, all of us, of course, that means God, but Lewis means it in a more specific sense. There's something, I'll bet, that each one of you is good at, that you particularly enjoy, uniquely enjoy almost. Maybe not uniquely, because you have friends, maybe, who should enjoy it. We have somebody who does stained glass, I know. That's a passion of his, right? I love stained glass. You wouldn't want to put me in charge of making it, but we've all got those things where I bet if Father Mark found somebody who did stained glass, they would just put it off probably and say, wow, you like stained glass too? You make stained glass too? That would be this connection, wouldn't it? We all have that kind of passion for various things. And Lewis talks a lot about the difference between companionship, as we'll see, and friendship. He means it in a deeper sense. I have something like 1,500 Facebook friends. They're not really friends. They're not friends even in the general human sense, much less Lewis's sense. I'm lucky if a few of them are really, truly friends in that deep sense. So we use friends really easily. It's a substitute for real friendships. 1,500 fake friendships equals kind of like one real one, I suppose, something like that. Haven't quite worked out the math on it yet. But so there is this joy that we see and recognize and partake of in each other, but even that is insufficient because it always points to a greater joy and a greater friendship, as we'll see, which is a friendship with God. The reference in the quote above, I don't think it's by coincidence that Lewis talks about there being an inkling of something greater. I think he's doing that knowing full well that he's already been a part of this group, this informal group called the Inklings. Now, Lewis, when he talks about friendship, and he doesn't do this in any one place, but somebody else is kind of put together in these three terms. First of all, he believes that each soul has a deep and inexpressible identity, a signature that distinguishes it from everybody else. So you are made in the image of God, and all of us together especially, but you also are uniquely made in the image of God. There's something about you that's uniquely you to some degree. Secondly, friendship is the recognition of a similar signature in somebody else, that you recognize yourself, but with a difference, in somebody else. And third, as close as that human friendship may be, just like we heard about with Lewis and Tolkien, there is always something insufficient about that human friendship that suggests there's an even greater intimacy and joy and friendship that is to be with God, that is here, but not fully yet. Now, if we look at the name, the Inklings, that was a name that they kind of informally gave themselves. It wasn't really a formal kind of club. There wasn't any charter you didn't have to sign to get in. It was sometimes humorous about people coming who somebody invited, the rest of them didn't want to be there. And there was no real easy way of kicking them out, because it wasn't that kind of a club. But it's presumably a double pun on the word ink. The ink, which we know is the blood of all literary creation. And also inkling in the sense of that idea of a glimmer of something that is beyond the present reality. There's an inkling. There is a premonition of something greater that exists. Now, the Inklings, when we're talking about friendships, if you wanted to define them, it's very hard because Bishop Sutton put a long list of people who were members of the Inklings at one time or another, but they weren't necessarily all together in the same place at the same time. People came in, came out over a period of a couple of decades. At any one meeting, you might find some but not others. But what really was the nucleus that brought them together was the fact that they were, above all, Lewis's friends. Lewis had this incredible ability to make and create deep friendships. So if you wanted to look at the core of what the Inklings is all about, it's really about friendships. It's about Lewis's deep friendships, not just companionship, but friendships based on things like love of poetry and a poetic worldview, as Bishop Sutton taught, a love of medieval worldview even. And in a sense also, since it's nice to have common enemies, a despising of modernity. They had that in common. These friendships with Lewis began by a taste of joy. This is how Lewis also defines friendships, that there is a taste that's shared in common that creates this experience of joy. And in particular, what the Inglis had in common was a love of literature. Now, they all came at it from different points of view. Sometimes they studied different literature. Tolkien was more of a philologist. Lewis was more of a medievalist and so on. Williams wasn't even a professor at all. He kind of talked his way into giving lectures at Oxford because he was so good, but he didn't really have the formal degrees to do it. And even Lewis's brother, who also was not trained to teach literature, he loved literature, and he wrote books of history that people read. So everyone had a love of literature. Without that, they probably just wouldn't have been interested, right? They also had something of a poetic worldview. That is, that there is the poetry speaks the truth. It's not just fantasy. That this poetic language that Bishop Sutton was describing, that is difficult at times and requires work, but suggests something beyond the superficial level of language. They held that in common. And they all stood in contrast to modern views, which were right there in the literatures of departments of literature and English at Oxford. There was a huge battle about whether you should teach any literature after the Romantic poets or not, which is the early part of the 19th century. And Lewis and Tolkien were on the side of no, they shouldn't. Lewis was a little looser than that, but Tolkien, I mean, for him, I think anything, you know, beyond the Middle Ages was kind of, that's just ridiculously modern. That's just, you know, way too, he liked, as you can tell, really old things. Once Tolkien began to write an epic poem about the Inklings in the style of Beowulf, sounds just like Tolkien, and only Tolkien could have done this, right? That expressed poetically the timbre of the friendship, maybe better than any other definition. Here's what he says. Lo, we have heard in old days of the wisdom and cunning-minded Inklings, how these wise ones sat together in the deliberations, skillfully reciting learning and song craft, earnestly meditating. That was true joy. So he throws in joy there in the Inklings, and he's surely has talked to Lewis about all this stuff, and he decides to put it to verse, right? That's the way that they thought. Another way of saying this is coming from Lewis himself. He says, oh, for the people who speak one's own language. Remember that Tolkien was a philologist, and for him, the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, as Bishop Sutton said, it was all about language. And what Lewis wanted was somebody who spoke the same language, somebody who had these things in common. And he didn't mean simply modern English where we could understand the same words, but that same poetic language of the heart. If you will, it's kind of an undoing of the Tower of Babel, right? That there is this unity that you find in this friendship that you don't find among other people. You might remember as well that in Lewis's Space Trilogy, that the main character is Ransom. What is his profession? That you should know, Calvin, just been reading. What is he?
He's a philologist.
He's a philologist. He studies words. And actually, Ransom may not have known this is really Tolkien. This is a fictional representation of Tolkien. And Tolkien himself realized that Ransom is really him. He said, I don't know how far he got into it before he realized, I think that's me. I think I'm supposed to be Ransom. And he is. Now, later in life, in The Four Loves, Lewis, of course, defines four kinds of loves. One of those kinds of love is friendship. And he says this of the Inklings. He says, to be sure we had a common point of view, and this is important, but we had it before we met. In other words, we didn't meet and hang out together and somehow we converged and created this common point of view. We had this common worldview before we met. And it was the cause rather than the result of our friendship. That is, the fact that we have all these things in common creates this deep friendship that we don't have with other people. He says this as well about friendship and distinguishing it from mere companionship, which is more common. Friendship arises out of mere companionship when two or more of the companions discover that they have in common some insight or interest or even taste which the others do not share, and which till that moment each believed to be his own unique treasure or burden. And instantly they stand together in an immense solitude. The typical expression of opening friendship would be something like this. What? You too? I thought I was the only one. There's that joy of discovering that there's somebody who is a fit friend for you, who has the same passions and desires as you have. As Lewis put it, lovers, we usually imagine them being kind of face to face. They're kind of gazing at each other. That's what they're beholding. But with friends, they're standing side by side because they're not looking primarily at each other. They're looking at this common thing that they love. And in fact, it's really interesting. They have somewhat different views of friendship than maybe I do. They rarely talk about things as the Inklings other than their work, their literature, perhaps theology to some degree. They rarely talked about their wives or children. In fact, we'll see, they tried hard to keep those things separate in a way that I don't find that I could do if I wanted even. But their friendship was commonly focused on something else, not themselves as friends. And Lewis also says, again, this is from the Four Loves, he talks about the ancient world. That's where he gets a lot of his foundation for what he's thinking. He says, for the ancients, friendship seemed the happiest and most fully human of all loves. The crown of life and the school of virtue, the modern world in comparison, ignores it. So much so that Lewis, and I think perhaps Tolkien believed this, that they, unlike Charles Williams, they would say that this love, this friendship love, stands even above marital or romantic love. And I disagree with him on that point. But they would put it at the very top. And that's a very typical 19th, early 20th century worldview, especially coming out of boys' schools in England, out of Oxford, a very kind of male-dominated society where there's lots of male-on-male close relationships. Lewis believed that the deepest of worldly emotions in early history was the love of man for man, the affection between a vassal and his lord, or the affection between two warriors. And he says this, long before history began, we, meaning men, have got together and done things. We enjoyed one another's society greatly. We, braves, we hunters, all bound together by shared skill, shared dangers and hardships, esoteric jokes away from the women and children. That's kind of his vision for friendship. Tolkien has well developed or devoted the greater part of his affection for his deep male friendships. And he was to some degree, at least his biography says, was able to divide his life into almost watertight compartments. Here's family and here's friends, and we don't want the two worlds to mix. And maybe there's some kind of purity that he was trying to achieve out of that. Tolkien thought that male friendship could only be gained and then maintained by a deliberate and almost ruthless exclusion of attention to his wife. That is, that I've got to give less attention to my wife so I can focus to a greater degree on these male friendships. Naturally, Edith Tolkien had a different point of view. She resented, to a large degree, these male friendships that seemed to crowd out some of the time and space in her husband's heart for her. So I don't really agree with that particular point of view. And in good, great Inkling fashion, because I feel like I'm continuing that great conversation they have. I feel like I'm part of it. I was just in the Eagle and Child a month ago with Charlie, sitting in their chair, and I feel like I have every right to join in the conversation, and as they would want me to do, to disagree with them violently and say, you're wrong. Sorry, you're wrong. You shouldn't like allegory. Sorry, you're wrong. You should put romantic love above all. Charles Williams is on my side, by the way, so we're kind of teaming up on Tolkien and Lewis together because he felt that romantic love was the greatest. Now, he has some pretty funky ideas about it, granted, but still, he did put it at the highest degree. Lewis also said this about the importance of male friendships. Friendship is the greatest of worldly goods. Certainly, to me, it is the chief happiness of life. If I had to give a piece of advice to a young man about a place to live, I think I should say, sacrifice almost everything to live where you can be near your friends. And he's talking especially about male friends. Interesting. That's how much they value these friendships. That's important in understanding the dynamics between them and how it influenced their work that we all love so much. Now, one of the biographers of the Inklings, a guy named Humphrey Carpenter, who's one of the main sources I'm looking at, he said that, again, Lewis's friendships were, in essence, the Inklings. That's what constituted them more than anything else. And Lewis had this unique ability to create friends, and not just a lot of acquaintances, but deep friends. And he, of course, was much more extroverted than Tolkien was, so it made it easier. And so you can look at Lewis's life and how he grew spiritually and as a writer in terms of his friendships, because we're really meant to be, created to be social creatures. We think of the great C.S. Lewis or the great Tolkien, but it's better to think of people in terms of how they work together, because that's what we're created for, is this friendship, this companionship. And so, the first friend in Lewis's life, who would you imagine it would be? If you know anything about his biography? His brother, good. And his brother's name was Warner or Warney. And he's got this kind of seminal moment, almost a poetic, mystical moment with Warney, who's his older brother.
And older brothers are great because they show you all sorts of new worlds and vistas.
Right, Charlie? That's what the older brothers are for. He took a biscuit tin, this is Warney, and decorated it with tiny twigs and moss and flowers. And he created this sort of fairy tale land in the middle of this just biscuit tin. And Lewis, who was just a little kid at the time, he was so impressed by that, it gave him this vision of a whole other world. Some people think that Narnia began at that moment in his heart, in his mind. Just this little game that his brother made up out of something that was just lying around.
So Warney was especially important.
Second was a man, or a boy originally, and then a man named Arthur Greaves, who was his long-term childhood friend. Arthur not only helped Lewis define friendship, but he also embodied it for perhaps the first time. And their friendship began by this sharing of a taste of joy. They had things in common that other people didn't.
And what they had in common in particular was a vision of beauty and poetry and literature.
But these friendships also have to have differences. You don't want to clone of yourself. That would be, you know, miserably boring, right? But there are enough differences where they learn from each other and they test each other, and that turns out to be extraordinarily important. So Arthur began to expand and transform Lewis's perspective on literature. Just like Lewis, I'm sure, challenged Tolkien's view of what literature was. Tolkien was much more of a purist than Lewis. Arthur persisted in persuading Lewis that attraction and beauty could be found in what he called not just northernness. That was what drew Tolkien and Lewis together, this kind of old Norse mythology. But Arthur Graves taught Lewis that this beauty, delight, this world of poetry could be found in the small and humble things of the world, which is what Arthur Greaves called homeliness. And that became really important in the works of Lewis, didn't it? That it wasn't just the big, giant, heroic figures. It's the common person who figures very prominently. He would not have had that view of things without Greaves. He may have been stuck in a more ancient world where it's really the heroic, the classically heroic type, rather than the common people becoming heroes. He picked that up from Arthur Greaves. He also was the one that, along with Warney, first introduced Lewis to the idea of joy, that shared deep fellowship. Next in the 1920s, probably the most important friend he had was Owen Barfield, one of the Inklings that Bishop Sutton mentioned that we don't hear as much about, although I'm glad to see that one of the workshops at the conference here is actually on Barfield. He's also perhaps the most mysterious to me, but partially I've read less about him, partially because he's a little harder to figure out. He's just kind of an oddball. He comes off from a different direction. In the 20s and 30s, he developed a deep friendship as well with Tolkien. And then during World War II, was especially Charles Williams. And what's interesting about these friendships is sometimes they get set one over the other and they all continue. Warney continues forever. Arthur Greaves probably would have continued forever, except he dies and he can't continue that friendship. And then, but the real sparks fly between Tolkien and Williams. There's a sense in which, maybe this is putting too strong, but Lewis had a man crush on Williams, I think. It was like really, I mean, he just was just, didn't quite fall in love with him. Well, maybe the male friendship kind of love, but that is that he really, there was something that really particularly he gravitated towards. And he had a very magnetic personality, Williams did. He was something of a ladies' man as well. But so Lewis had this attachment to Williams that after that, things were never the same between he and Tolkien, because it was as if Williams is in the same room as Lewis and Tolkien. Lewis is, you've had this before, seen this before in your own life, maybe, like me. He'd always give a turn to talk to Williams, as if, now, who's the guy you're sitting with us right now, and suddenly, well, he's always second fiddle. And you can see how Tolkien may have been a little bit offended by that, because he was there first. And after all, he was, although not yet. If that makes sense. And then in the 50s, Joy Davidman. His, first of all, somebody he corresponded with, and then met in person, and then eventually married, became his greatest friend of all. Until her death in 1960. Now, what did they do with these friendships? Well, in order to develop these friendships, they had a different sense than we do, I think, of time. That is, they spent a lot of time together.
more than we tend to do.
They had, of course, as I've already mentioned, common taste. That was kind of what brought them together in the first place. They also had the idea of what was most important in life, so that Lewis said it's really important to have the same idea of what are the most important questions in life. It's not important, by the way, he said, to always have the same answers. But you better have in common the idea that this is what's most important in life. So even if there's all sorts of contentions about what the answer is, at least you're on the same page, you have a common taste for what's really important. And he did this all the time with his friends. That was part of what I think made the Inklings so engaging. It wasn't what didn't take place in the Inklings meetings. It was what takes place now when you get a bunch of writers together. We all have these really fragile egos. We all say to each other, wow, that was wonderful. And then they come and you read your stuff and you say, wow, that was wonderful. And no, it probably isn't wonderful. You know, I want you to tell me the truth. And then, of course, the answer is, well, you can't handle the truth. You know, you would probably question me. You probably would never write again. They didn't do that. They had excellent criticism for each other because they were eminently qualified, but they told you what was good and what needed to be corrected. And sometimes they never saw eye to eye, but they agreed about what was important in life, and they never lost that. They spent a lot of time together, and interestingly, to read the biographies, what always comes up in every stage of Lewis's life and all these friendships is how much time they spent. We think of them drinking in pubs. More than that, it's walking together. It's a very English thing to do. We don't do it as much anymore. You see people walking in England all the time still to this day. We prefer the car. It's a different kind of experience than walking, but they're walking everywhere together. Sometimes they're just walking to be walking and just talking to be talking without an upfront purpose. There wasn't really ever an agenda that said, you know, at 4:30, Tolkien is going to speak and drawn on and on about his latest, you know, part of Lord of the Rings, and then at 5:30, Lewis is going to talk about his. It wasn't like that. It was rather free-flowing. There wasn't a schedule. Sometimes they just talked to be talking because they enjoyed each other's company. Lewis and Barfield often took holidays together. Lewis and Tolkien spent a lot of time with each other, not just at the Inklings meetings, but there were also meetings on another day where they got together, and sometimes just in impromptu ways. They would go out for walks together. So there's this constant refreshment they got from being in each other's presence. And a lot of time that was through walking. Outside of term time, that is, when they're not engaged in their teaching duties, they would go on vacations together, and they'd go on afternoon walks together. So lots and lots of time together without really any ulterior purpose other than simply to hang out with one another. This is also important in the formation of the character of Charles Williams. Early in life, his best friend was really his father. He spent a lot of time with him, and the two went for these long walks together, and it formed Williams' character. He got a lot of his theological and literary ideas from his father on these long walks. Now, Tolkien believed that friendships were extraordinarily important as well. And Bishop Sutton alluded to some of the similarities in the biography between Lewis and Tolkien. One of the things that Lewis experienced that had a profound impact on him, of course, was this idea of the loss of community. He had lots of important people in his life that were lost to him. First and foremost, his parents. But then a succession of friends that he lost in World War I. One by one, it seems like his relationships withered and died. And you can see this reflected. It's kind of the subtext in many parts of Lord of the Rings. The importance of friendship, the danger and peril of losing these friendships, which really is almost tantamount to life itself. While the loss of his mother and father are things that just happen, you can't really blame modernity, Tolkien believed that the being robbed of his friendships, a lot of that can be placed at the door of World War I, which he equated very much with modernity. That was this first, perhaps, total war,
the Great War, World War I.
And in that, he and Lewis, to a lesser degree, they saw kind of the embodiment of all of the evils of modernity. And if you think of the pictures of this new technology that's out there, you've got machine guns, you've got tanks, you've got airplanes, you've got all this new technology that is utterly destructive. And you see that reflected in Lord of the Rings. You see that here's kind of the march of modernity. And what Tolkien is writing so much about is the preservation of the more rural, kind of pastoral life that he cherished so much. And he constantly saw that modernity and urbanization and industrialization are constantly encroaching on this sacred land. That's kind of really what the Lord of the Rings is all about. And he said that in one of his offhanded comments later in life.
And he would say,
and he perhaps is right, that this loss of community, whether it's family or friends or the lifestyle we used to have, that's kind of the heart of
postmodernity. Not just modernity, but postmodernity in particular.
And that what Tolkien was really trying to accomplish with his literature was to fight the trends of the modern world with poetry, with imagination, with myth, with Christian romance, and then especially with Christian friendship. So Christian friendship is really restorative. It's a way to combat the evils of modernity and the ways that those friendships are broken down like by modernity. Now, when we look at the friendships of the Inkwings, they didn't set out to use the Inkwings as a means of producing great literature. And yet, that was the byproduct, or that was the fruit, of these deep, deep relationships that they had one with another. Tolkien acknowledged that without Lewis's encouragement over many years, The Lord of the Rings would never have appeared in print. Now, this doesn't mean he wouldn't have written it. The Lord of the Rings is something that Tolkien's working on for several decades in his mind and in his heart, so he's going to write this no matter what, but he wouldn't have ever bothered to publish it if he hadn't had constant feedback and encouragement by Lewis. You see, you need that other friend to confirm in him this is something that's worth publishing and that there's a place for it in this world that other people would really benefit by reading it. Tolkien says this. He mentions the unpayable debt that I owe to him, talking about Lewis. It was not influence as it is ordinarily understood, but sheer encouragement. He was, from early on, my only audience. Only from him did I ever get the idea that my stuff could be more than a private hobby. And that's hard for us to believe. Here it is, Lord of the Rings, which people think may have been the greatest work of the 20th century. And that's just a hobby. Remember, he loves language. He's just playing around with language, writing this story for 30 years in his head. No big deal, right? And it's from Lewis, from that friendship, that person who's like you but not like you, who comes and confirms, this is really good. This is good stuff. This is more than just a hobby. This is great literature. This is the kind of thing that we've been waiting for, that we've been talking about, and you've written it. Go do something with it. And Tolkien wrote in 1929, friendship with Lewis compensates for much. This man who felt that he had suffered the loss of a lot, there's this rock-solid friendship with Lewis. You can also imagine that around 1939, when Williams comes more on the scene, how having that friendship be diminished in some sense by the presence of Williams was also just kind of an existential crisis for Tolkien. Friends also, they test and they strengthen us. They not only encourage us, but they make us stronger because they test us in ways that we will not and cannot test ourselves. When you're trying to produce great art, it's absolutely crucial that you get good feedback. All sorts of people can pick up a pen and a brush to paint, or can get on the computer to write, but to write great literature, to produce great art, you need some kind of great critics around you. People making you better, saying, here's why this is insufficient. This doesn't really flow. This doesn't fit. That's anachronistic. That's illogical. This doesn't seem to fit over there. Somebody giving you really good, consistent feedback in a constructive way, but giving you honest, serious kinds of criticism. That's important. You need somebody like Tolkien saying to Lewis about the Chronicles of Narnia, in essence, this is my paraphrase, of course, that stinks. I really don't like you mixing all these genres. You can only do one genre at any one work. Lewis is saying, oh yeah, well, show me that rule. Where does he say you can't do that? Ancient writers did that to some degree. So you need somebody saying, I don't like that, but here's why. It's not just, I don't like it and that's all I can tell you. That's not very useful. Friendships make me more me. That is, they bring out more of who I am. Lewis and Arthur Greaves, they sharpen each other. They enhance certain aspects they wouldn't have seen in each other. And hopefully, they also take the rough edges off of places that you wouldn't have been able to do by yourself. Lewis says this about friends. Men who have real friends are less easy to manage or get at. He meant there's strength in these true friendships. One man by himself is easy to pick off. Two men who are strong friends are more than twice as strong. You've got somebody there to protect you, to strengthen you, to confirm and encourage you. Friendship can be a school of virtue, but also a school of vice. It makes good men better and bad men worse. So being a friend makes you more you, in a sense. This idea of friendship also reflects the unity and diversity that is the heart of all creation because it's the heart of the Trinity. Unity and diversity. Lewis says that in friendship, unlike in romantic love, where the two are looking at each other and there's no room for anybody else, and there shouldn't be. You're locked into each other, there's one man, there's one woman, that's it. That's all you get. In a true friendship, they're always willing to welcome more people in. Because remember, they're not looking at each other, looking at the common thing out there. So the more is the merrier, in one sense, as long as that person you're invited in has the same vision. That's why the Inklings could have a meeting of 6 or 8 or 12 people. As long as they had that common vision, then in some sense, the more is the merrier. And 3 is better than 2. And 4 is better than 3, because there's this kind of multiplication effect. Lewis says this: in each of my friends, not just Tolkien, not just Williams, but in each of my friends, there is something that only some other friend can fully bring out. That is that if I have 2 friends and I want to know more about friend A and fully experience him, I need friend B to bring out parts of friend A that I don't do by myself. There are certain parts of friend A that I see only when friend B is around. Have you ever noticed that? Interesting. By myself, I'm not large enough to call the whole man into activity. I want other lights than my own to show all of this man. In this, friendship exhibits a glorious nearness by resemblance to heaven itself, where the very multitude of the blessed, which no man can number, increases the fruition which each has of God. So in heaven, he imagines that the fact that we are all worshiping God in common, and we're doing it side by side, that only enhances our vision of God and our union with him. For every soul, seeing him in her own way, doubtless communicates that unique vision to all the rest. So you all see God slightly differently than I do. If you were able to communicate that to me, and I to you, and all of us together, we'd have a much better vision of God than my kind of two-dimensional, monochromatic vision of God, which I have too often. We need each other to see God in 3D Kodachrome. The Inklings, somebody has said, are almost like the church. That is, where 2 or 3 are gathered together, there you have the Inklings. And there you have this kind of deep friendship that we've been talking about. Friends also are great for showing you new worlds. They show you things that you couldn't have seen by yourself. And furthermore, they give you a compelling vision for that world. They say, in essence, now that we've got this in common, I also like this. Why don't you come on over and try this sandwich? Or try this beer? Or listen to this music? Or watch this movie? Things you wouldn't have done by yourself. And sometimes you still say, blah, that's, I'm sorry, that's just not, never going to like that. Other times you catch a taste for it, don't you? And you're exposed to new worlds you never would have investigated by yourself. Lewis came to believe that friendship could restore health and how we view things, and we could even change our very perceptions of reality. If you notice that, if you have a really good friend, and that could be almost anybody, they help you to see the world differently, hopefully better. Because remember, friends can go both ways. They can lead you astray as well. This is related to Lewis's idea of the reader is, in a sense, a friend. You may not have thought about it that way, but if you read Lewis deeply with a common vision for the world that he has, he would probably consider you a friend. And if we believe in the community of saints, then I'm not just making a figure of speech. There's a sense in which you're a friend of Lewis. If you see what he saw, that draws you together, this common vision, so that in writing even, there is this kind of intimacy that's created. And Lewis very much believed that in his writing, unlike some other writers. Friends, they help us, they help to convert us, and they help sanctify us. This is certainly true in Lewis's life. Bishop Sutton mentioned that moment in 1931 with a couple of Lewis's friends, Dicey and Tolkien, but that was part of a long succession of friends who brought him back closer to Christ. If he had the wrong friends or no friends, he might have easily been left in his atheism, and we would not be sitting here talking about C.S. Lewis. Friends have an influence on your character, and this is what Lewis found out for Arthur Greaves. It wasn't just that they shared common taste and that Lewis developed a different view of literature and so on, but even his character. He began to think about, well, what would Arthur say about this? And how would Arthur feel about this? And Lewis really practiced the art of writing and the art of imagining an audience in his letters to Arthur Greaves when he was a young man. Just briefly, I want to talk about some of the influences on literature. There's a lot more of these. These are just some I came across. Lewis read a book by Williams called The Place of the Lion. And he says that sometimes a book sometimes crosses one path, which is like the sound of one's native language in a strange country. That is, you've read it and you see it, you feel like, I've been there before. that sounds really familiar. I really like that. It is, to me, one of the major literary events of my life, comparable to my first discovery of George MacDonald, G.K. Chesterton, or William Morris. Now, Out of the Silent Planet, which Lewis wrote in 1938, was born directly out of his friendship with Tolkien. They were sitting in their meeting one day, and Lewis said this. He said, one of the nicknames for Tolkien was, it's hard to imagine having names like Jack and Tolles, T-O-L-L-E-R-S, but you know Tolles.
There's too little that we really like in stories. I'm afraid we shall have to write some ourselves. One of us should write a tale of time travel and the other of space travel. So they arm wrestled for it, of course, and Lewis lost.
So he had to write the one of space travel, and Tolkien got to write the one of time travel, except it wasn't so much time travel, it was Earth, but in a different time. But the first part of that's true. I mean, but they really do have this conversation. Nobody else is out there writing the literature we want. Let's write it. And we've got to do space and time travel. And that's that was the impetus for the whole space trilogy. After hearing Williams read a play of his in one of the Inquis meetings, because they read out loud to each other, Lewis had the idea for the Screwtape Letters, because Lewis was, Williams was keenly interested in the occult. In fact, Tolkien, especially, and also Lewis, felt he was too attracted to the occult. There's probably some truth in that. But in these deep discussions about the devil and about the occult, out of that, Lewis had the idea for the Screwtape Letters. If you read That Hideous Strength, with, again, the third part of the Space Trilogy, if you know anything about Lewis's connection with Williams, there's a lot of Charles Williams and Charles Williams' theology in That Hideous Strength. And then, of course, Surprised by Joy has all sorts of connections with Joy David. Another thing that friendships are good for, I'm going to have to cut this part a little bit short, unfortunately, but friendships are good ultimately for building God's kingdom. Lewis said it could be argued that friendships are of practical value to community. Every civilized religion began with a small group of friends. Mathematics effectively began when great friends got to talk about numbers and lines and angles. And he's talking about way back in the Greeks' time. The Royal Society, you may know some in the 1660s in London. The Romantic movement, people like Wordsworth and Coleridge, very close friends. Communism, unfortunately. Tractarianism, the Oxford movement, which I'll talk about briefly. Methodism, the fight against slavery, the Reformation, the Renaissance. All these, Lewis said, were born out of friendships. It wasn't just distant people who happened to have the same idea or some spontaneous swelling of an underground movement. These are people who knew each other well and were friends and created these movements. Now, I want to talk briefly about the Oxford movement, which I'm quite familiar with. The three great leaders of the Oxford movement were John Henry Newman, John Keble, and Edward Pusey in the beginning of the 1830s. And it's interesting that, again, this great reform movement of the 19th century in the Church of England began in Oxford, and began with a close group of male friends. There's something in Oxford that lent itself to these close male friendships, part because it was only males who were allowed to attend Oxford at the time. There was a serious intellectual, literary, philosophical world there that people joined in. Also, if you were not on the modern side of things, then you had, again, a kind of common enemy that you were fighting. In the 1830s, Keble was the oldest of these three. He was Newman's tutor, so he taught John Henry Newman, who eventually surpassed him as being the leader of the Oxford movement. But it's these men sitting around, talking about the future of the church, particularly in 1833, that launched the Oxford movement, which was the great reform movement that brought back, in a sense, the Catholic side of Anglicanism. Without the Oxford movement, Anglicanism may not have been what it is today. It might have still just drifted off into being just one more kind of Protestant sect. Because what they did is they said, we've got to re-envision the church on a different basis. This idea of the church and state being close like this, and the state being able to tell the church what to do, that just is not the apostolic model. So what happened in 1833, there were a number of reform bills in England in the early 19th century, long overdue in many ways. One of them was to kind of consolidate the churches in the Church of Ireland, that is the Protestant part of it. And in so doing, of course, who has the right in England to get rid of bishoprics? That is, here's a place where we used to support bishops as Parliament. But what happened to Parliament in the 1820s and 30s is people who were no longer members of the Church of England could now be members of Parliament. So what does that mean? It means you've got people who are members of parliament telling the Church of England what to do, who have no vested interest in the Church of England, in fact, maybe the opposite. And eventually, Roman Catholics become members of parliament, and atheists and so on. So what Cable did is he gave a very famous sermon, actually it was Bastille Day. Same day, Church of England decided to consecrate women bishops, July 14th. Only it was 1833. He gave what was known as the Assize Sermon, and the title of it was National Apostasy. And what he was saying is basically a reaction to this idea that the state can tell the church what to do. And from that, they met together and they said, what are we going to do about this? And they launched the Oxford Movement. And it was particularly Newman who said, well, rather than creating an organization and, you know, having a lot of bureaucracy, let's just write a bunch of tracts. Let's appeal to the people, and let's write tracts on various subjects. And the tracts for the times began with what they called the Tractarians. And out of that, they brought back the model of the church. The church is not founded by the state. It's founded upon what they called an apostolical model. That is, it comes from the apostles. They're the foundation. And they revolutionized the Church of England out of those friendships. Some of you may be familiar with another. I'm going to skip over the Clapham sect. I encourage you to read about the Clapham sect. They were some of the evangelicals of the evangelical revival in the 18th century. People like William Wilberforce and so on. Getting rid of slavery, a few small things like that. Founding all sorts of charitable organizations, especially interested in foreign missions. It came out of a close association of family and friends in a suburb of London. Some of you may know of this duo, famous duo of Lennon. There was a recent article this month, July 2014, talks about the power of two. And what he's saying is that out of this relationship between Paul McCartney and John Lennon, you have something called the Beatles created that would not have existed if it were just one or the other. That is, that they needed each other. The essence of the relationship was relational. In fact, some people have said that you really should see Lennon and McCartney as being one single creative being. And there's kind of, if you know anything about the Beatles, after they split up, people have their various impressions about what happens to Paul and John when they split up. Neither one's as good, frankly. That's kind of, and I kind of agree with that hypothesis. But they shared a common vision. They shared similar musical tastes. They shared a grand vision for what they wanted to do, and yet they were very different, extraordinarily different. Paul was meticulous and organized. John thrived on chaos, as you might imagine. Paul was a natural communicator. John had a hard time articulating his ideas. Paul was a diplomat. John was always the agitator. In fact, if you've ever seen the Beatles engage with reporters, there's always this banter that goes back and forth. Some of it, John really twists the knife. He gets all these really snide comments in, but the only reason he can do that is because Paul is sitting there being polite. So they work together in a way. Cynthia Lennon, who was John's first wife, said John needed Paul's attention to detail and persistence. Paul needed John's anarchic lateral thinking. They needed each other. And there's all sorts of ways in which working together, playing off each other, competing with each other even, they produce something greater than either one of them could have produced by himself. Now, when we think about friendships, the ultimate friend is God. Now, Lewis didn't like to talk about the friendship with God because he thought it was liable to be misunderstood. And it's true that it's not the primary image we see in the Bible. And yet, there are a couple of places where this is mentioned, most notably in John chapter 2, where Jesus says this, "Greater love has no man than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." And this is startling, isn't it? Because it's rarely used. Jesus says to us, "You are my friends." We imagine what Lewis is talking about. "You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends. For all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you." And so there is this closeness. God has drawn near to us close enough to call us a friend, to stand side by side with us. But that's only true if what, according to Lewis? If we're looking and seeing the same thing, which is the Father. If we're looking at each other, if we're looking at ourselves, then that fellowship with Christ, and therefore the Father, is broken. In this friendship with God, furthermore, there is a kind of reciprocity, right? Which is really the essence of the covenant. God makes promises to us. And as our friend, in a sense, covenantal friend, he always keeps our promises. We too, as God's friends in the covenant, We swear that we will uphold this friendship, our side of things, and when we don't, then we create this great divorce. I want to conclude by talking about, I'm almost out of time, the future of friendship, and just challenge you all, we have to cut this one short too, to think about the friendships in your life. This is a real challenge, especially for us guys. They say that the adult, white, heterosexual male has fewer friends than anybody else in the Western world today. And that's true if you look historically. We're out trying to be islands by ourselves. There's a lot of reasons for this. I haven't figured it all out, but some of it is that we're too busy. We say we're too busy. We don't have time for walks and talks. We're too busy always doing things, right? Some of it is that we have a particular view of masculinity. We don't think that it's masculine to sit around talking about literature and imagining worlds and talking about philosophy and theology. To be a man is out there to be doing outdoorsy kind of stuff, which is a vision for it, but is that the only vision we've got? That's nothing wrong with that, but true friendship, I think, is based on something deeper than those kinds of things. There's another issue that's out there, and Lewis actually spoke about this as early as 1950, and that's homosexuality. We're afraid that these close male friendships are homosexual. We may not be, but it starts early on. In junior high, you start getting persuaded that it's not a good thing to share your emotions with other guys. It's not a good thing to have a guy who's too close that you really bear your soul to, because that's gay, right? And so on. You're a fag. That's what they said in New York if you do that. Well, in the 70s, that was the chosen word back then. Lewis actually catches on to this in the 60s because he realizes that it's going to be a charge that's laid to them. In fact, if you look at the Irish movement, their relationships were extremely close and intimate. And people today, because they cannot conceive of male friendships with that degree of intimacy not being homosexual, they think that every one of them is homosexual. Because we've got this mindset. Well, if we're reacting to that, as we often do as Christians, we're going to stymie ourselves from producing those kinds of friendships that transformed the world in the past and have the opportunity to do it again. I hope that maybe here, even at this Anglican Way Institute, some of us who are developing and sharing a common vision, we move out of mere companionship, as Lewis would say, to something greater called friendship. That's my hope. And the only way that's going to happen is if there's some kind of intentionality. If we go back to simply business as usual, same way of seeing the world, same way of operating, then we'll go and leave from the Anglican Way Institute and not really ever fully apprehend the essence of what the Anglicans were all about. Unfortunately, I'm out of time, but I do want to take time for at least a question or two, just in case there's something that is urgent you had to say or ask that was... Anybody have any questions or comments? Yes.
Well, are you saying you disagree with the notion that that type of brotherhood is kind of love? What type of love do you believe?
I think that the highest love is between a man and a wife, because I think it's only between a man and a wife that we're called to be one flesh. And I think that the love between a man and a wife incorporates not only this erotic, romantic love, but also, ideally, and this is ideal, when I try to achieve with my own wife, it also includes the idea of friendship. So I think that it actually has friendship plus, in a way that a male friendship couldn't possibly, because there's no such thing as male marriage. So I think that there's a unique unity between man and woman. Also, I think that unity and diversity is best reflected by male and female, he created them. That's what I'm saying. Yes.
What about close male and female friendships that aren't?
Watch When Harry Met Sally. That's what I would know. Personally, I believe that it's very difficult. I think it's always been difficult. I think because of the nature of how we're created, that if you put a male and a female together in close proximity, they almost, and I know there will be exceptions, but the vast majority of the time, their romantic attraction will develop. This is why I think, tragically, pastors run off the church secretaries. There's nothing special about either of them, except they're in a lot of close proximity without other people around. I think there's a danger there, and I think the reason it is, we should respect it, because there's a difference between male and female. And so I think that's a very difficult thing. I think it's always been that way, but it may be even especially dangerous.
Doesn't mean you can't do it. But you should be aware of the one in.
That's always going to be the tendency. And what I've noticed almost universally is you may not start out having any feelings for that person at all. If you hang around long enough in an isolated way, then almost it's almost inevitable, because I think it's how we're made. I think we're fighting against God's created order if we think that that's really going to not happen. All right, well, I think we're out of time, so thank you very much.